2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 112, Why Christians Should Oppose the Death Penalty, a paper presented by William D. Russell with a response by L. K. Gillespie.
Welcome to the first session of the Sunstone Symposium 2002. My reaction is when I get up spontaneously like this is to bear my testimony, and that won't take long. Bill Russell is our presenter this morning, and I've known Bill ever since he was a marathoner. Bill Russell, of course, was president of the Mormon History Association, a past president of the John Whitmer Historical Association twice, I think, founder of Courage Magazine and professor of history and theology at Graceland University. And just a really good scholar. Been working at these symposiums for many years. I'm sure most of you are familiar with his work. And is an expert on the fundamentalist groups that have broken off, both from Mormonism and the RLDS, or Community of Christ group. So with that, and his commentator, if I can get down here to where I'm supposed to be, will be Kay Gillespie. On it, and you better know about much about Kay as I do, except he's a good guy. And so, anyway, with that introduction, let's have Bill take over. Thank you.
Good job. Yeah, he does a better job spontaneously than he does when he has advance notice. Now, once I had a new pastor, and the first day I was there, he got called into action to speak when a speaker didn't show up. I thought he did a pretty good job. Next week, he was the regular scheduled speaker. Didn't do nearly as well. So so he needed to go by the Spirit rather than, I guess, by his prepared remarks. In May of 1990, I received a call from Linda Putvin of the Ohio Public Defender's Office in Columbus, Ohio. She wanted me to help the legal defense team of Jeffrey Don Lundgren, the leader of a small RLDS breakaway cult. Jeff, the prophet and seer of this tiny cult, had readily admitted that he had killed a family of five, including a six-year-old girl, who were members of his group, because God, as revealed in the sacred word, had ordered that they be rebuked, that is, killed, because they were hopelessly unrepentant, thereby preventing the return of Christ and the establishment of Zion. I'm sure you had no trouble following that line of reasoning. I had no trouble accepting Linda's request that I serve in the defense team of a man who admitted a cold, calculated murder of five people. Now, my mother was anything but happy about it, though. Why are you helping that murderer, she asked. I think she might also have said what she really was probably thinking, and that is, why are you helping that man who gave the church such a bad name? That was a big concern for both of our churches, because Jeff had fairly recently been a tour guide at the Kirtland Temple. We RLDS have always been worried that people would confuse you with us, but here you were worried about being confused with us. And so I understand the LDS Church spent $250,000 on PR in Cleveland area after that case. Graceland president Barbara Higdon was also concerned. She asked me to stop by her office to discuss why I was going to Ohio to help Jeff so she could better handle any angry complaints that might come in. You know, like my mother might call her or something like that. I told her that I would, but when I got back to the office, it occurred to me that it was really a very simple matter. I had opposed the death penalty for about 35 years, since my senior year in high school. My only role in this trial would be to try to convince the jury that this man was sincere about his religious beliefs, so maybe the jury would decide not to execute him, but rather sentence him to life without parole. So I told President Higdon that it was really quite simple. I'm a long opponent of the death penalty, for one, and I also that I know that the legal system is an adversary system, which assumes that both sides of a dispute will have a chance to put on their best case, and neutral parties, the judge and the jury, will determine the law and the facts and apply it to the case. So my conversion to the pro-life position on the death penalty came in my senior year in high school. I had just written an essay for Miss Rhodes, our best English teacher Northern High School in Flint, and on the death penalty, and my position was clear. Kill them. They deserve it, and it will save the state money. I could tell by Miss Rhodes' comments in the margin that she wasn't impressed with my argument, so it sort of raised a doubt in my mind. And then very soon, there appeared a series of articles in the Detroit Free Press about a 17-year-old black man with an IQ of 75 named Willie Calloway, who happened to be in the vicinity when a murder took place. He was arrested, brought to trial, found guilty, and received a sentence of life in prison because Michigan is not a capital punishment state. Calloway had served more than 9 years before this enterprising reporter got on the case and wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles in the Free Press, raising serious doubts about Calloway's guilt. Calloway was freed after more than 9 years in prison. That's about 9.5 years is about the average time today that a person's on death row. So I presume back then his execution would have already taken place, because I presume they were executing sooner in those days before the liberal criminal justice decisions of the court in the 60s. Interestingly enough, a man named Duckett came forward after the articles were published and admitted that he had committed the murder. 6 years after that shallow essay on capital punishment, I was a young editor at the RLDS publishing house. Israel was about to execute Adolf Eichmann. If anybody deserves it, I'm sure Eichmann would. I read an article about the Jewish theologian Martin Buber, who had urged that Israel should show mercy on Eichmann and thereby show mercy to one who had not shown any mercy to his victims. Well, Israel did not listen to Buber, and they executed Eichmann, but to the best of my knowledge, as of today, Israel has still not executed anybody else but Eichmann. It's the only one I believe they've ever done. I wrote an editorial in our official magazine, the Saints Herald, supporting Buber's position, and later an article in our youth magazine, Stride. While there were certainly critics of my anti-capital punishment position, for many Latter-day Saints, be they organized or reorganized, all they had to do was turn to the Doctrine and Covenants, section 42.2, in the RLDS Doctrine and Covenants. It's also section 42 in your DNC, differing only that it's verse 79 in yours. That's a very small distinction, but an important one, because ours is the one true versification system. But the passage in question reads, "And it shall come to pass that if any person among you shall kill, they shall be delivered up and dealt with according to the laws of the land. For remember that he hath no forgiveness, and it shall be proven according to the laws of the land." Of course, there is ample support for the death penalty in the Mosaic Law, in the Hebrew Bible. Punishment by death is prescribed for many things, including trespassing, contempt of parents, sorcery, bestiality, sacrifice to a foreign god, profaning the Sabbath, adultery, incest, homosexuality, and prostitution, and many others. So supporters of the death penalty can find plenty of scriptural warrant for their position. For many Christians, life's complex problems are often solved by a passage of Holy Scripture which is simple, direct, and clearly speaking to the issue, and is dead wrong, and sometimes downright immoral. While for many saints, this one statement from Joseph Smith on February 9, 1831, settles the matter, without the need to consult any other scriptures or the need to especially to consult the four Gospels and their portrayal of Jesus, nor any need to consult reason or human experience, some people will simply recite a scripture and be done with the discussion. Although my theory is that most people, even the most fundamental saints, and by that I mean strict constructionists of the Bible or the scriptures, I think the most fundamental saints still apply reason in the lessons of experience, but just don't maybe realize that they are, and thinking they're just using the scripture as their source of authority. Regarding capital punishment, please don't misunderstand me here. Every large society has criminals so dangerous that they must not be allowed to walk the streets again. The only question is, do we kill them? And I think the Christian position has to be no. I oppose capital punishment for practical as well as moral reasons, but I'll begin with the practical reasons and deal with them briefly because the moral arguments are more important for this paper. First is the economic argument. I was naive when I presumed in a high school class that in 1956 that it was cheaper to execute than to hold someone on death row for the rest of their lives. But my current state senator in Iowa was even more naive when he made the argument in 1999 when he first ran for the Iowa State Senate. He thought that it would save taxpayers money. Yet all studies show execution costing the state at least twice as much and sometimes much more than that, times the amount it would take to imprison a person for life. He was urging that Iowa restore the death penalty, which was abolished in Iowa during the administration of Governor Harold Hughes in the 1960s. Interestingly enough, the Iowa Association of County Attorneys, the prosecutors, they supported the death penalty when the issue came up in 1995. But they didn't lobby on its behalf. They knew it was wise politically to support capital punishment because of the opinion polls and so forth, and they have to get elected. But most of Iowa's 99 counties are small, and those county attorneys know that one capital murder case could bankrupt a small Iowa county. They also know that the money would be much better spent on resources that would actually help deter crime, like more and better trained and better paid police officers and so forth. It's much better to spend our money that way than to select some people for death. Secondly is the deterrence argument. Supporters of the death penalty have often assumed that it will deter capital crimes. The theory of general deterrence holds that when you punish citizen A, you potentially deter others in society from committing that same crime because they're aware of what happened to citizen A. But there appears to be a clear scholarly consensus that capital punishment does not deter the commission of capital crimes. It's interesting to note that the 38 states with capital punishment have a murder rate nearly twice as high as the 12 states which do not engage in state-sponsored killing, like my home state of Iowa. On the other hand, specific deterrence holds that when you punish citizen A, you deter citizen A from committing the same crime again. The cost was too high, so citizen A does not have to want to pay that price again. Or if the penalty is incarceration or death, then citizen A cannot commit that crime again because he or she is dead or restrained by electric wire fences. A third practical argument is that it's a little harder to get convictions when the penalty is death rather than life imprisonment. The standard for conviction in our criminal system is guilt beyond reasonable doubt. That does not mean guilt beyond all doubt. Guilt beyond reasonable doubt allows for that small measure of doubt that finally does not rise to the level of reasonable doubt. It seems to me that there's a subtle difference that sometimes comes into play in capital cases, wherein a jury that would convict in a non-capital case will be a little reluctant to convict when there's that little bit of doubt that still is not reasonable doubt. But in capital cases, the severity of the sentence leads to that higher standard, it seems to me, in the mind of the jury, that is, has to be guilt beyond all doubt. Just an example of my own personal acquaintanceship. I know several mass murderers and so forth. I was on a panel here with Mark Hoffman one time, so, you know, I just know all of them. I have an acquaintance who's serving life without parole in the Iowa State Penitentiary. He came once to see me about a political matter. Fortunately, he was in good mood that day. But about a year later, he apparently murdered his brother's wife, and their two kids. The evidence was all circumstantial, but it did amount to a great bit of circumstantial evidence and a good case, and I think he was probably guilty. But I suspect if Iowa had the death penalty, the jury would have had a reasonable chance of being acquitted or hung jury simply because it was all circumstantial evidence and people would be a little bit reluctant to send somebody to the chair on circumstantial evidence. In less serious crimes, you have a similar situation if the penalty is so out of proportion to the evil caused by the crime that the jury is just not willing to convict. This is what we call jury nullification. I remember hearing years ago that Texas had a statute that you could get 99 years for possession of marijuana. Well, I suspect if there are jurors that knew that was the maximum penalty, they might be a little bit leery of sending this nice little teenager that's been puffing a little weed up to prison for life. Okay, now let's look at the moral arguments. This paper argues that capital punishment is both immoral and impractical, and should be abolished in both religious, on both religious and secular grounds by Christians, including those of us who call ourselves saints. It's my view that the life and teachings of the humble carpenter from Nazareth are a lens through which we can view society, calling into judgment those things which appear to be in conflict with that witness. But as a faith community becomes successful in the ways the world measures success, like building impressive churches and universities and attaining material prosperity for its members and achieving stardom as Olympic champions and quarterbacks of the 49ers and so forth, it becomes easy to live in a relatively low state of tension with the surrounding culture. As part of the get tough on crime attitude, the American public today favors the death penalty for the most serious crimes. Many Christians, influenced by their culture, adopt the view, even though it's in conflict with the Christian gospel. Many of us in the community of Christ agree with Tony Shavala Smith, our theologian in residence, who says that the community of Christ now tends to look at Joseph Smith through the eyes of Jesus, but when we were a sect, thinking we were the true church, we looked at Jesus through the eyes of Joseph. Thus, we would review section 42 of the Doctrine and Covenants now through the lens provided by the four Gospels, and we would find it wanting. The first moral argument is that clearly we are sentencing to death a significant number of innocent people. Recently, the governors of Illinois and Maryland, one Republican and one Democrat, have declared a moratorium on the death penalty in their states because of the alarming number of persons on death row in recent years whose convictions have been overturned. Since the restoration of the death penalty in the late 70s, at least 100 death row inmates in the United States have had their death sentences overturned for a variety of reasons, including DNA evidence. As Ken Driggs said in his Dialogue article in 96, innocent people are sentenced to death in part because the quality of the defense provided to indigents is often pathetic, fiscal pressures, poor compensation of appointed counsel, public outrage over the crime, and a shortage of competent death penalty lawyers all contribute to this. So it really should be no surprise that innocent people are sentenced to death and executed in some cases. Certainly there are other innocent people who remain on death row. One of those who was released, Richard Dexter of Joplin, Missouri, spoke to my introduction to criminal justice class in Graceland 3 months ago. It was an eye-opening experience for my students, mostly criminal justice majors, who tend to assume criminal defendants are guilty as charged, particularly if they've been convicted. Hugh Adam Bedeau and Michael Radelot, in their 1987 article in the Stanford Law Review, found 130 people mistakenly convicted and sentenced to death in the period 1900 to 1985, with 23 actually executed. They have all sorts of levels of doubt about these cases in the article. On June 11th and 12th of 2000, the Chicago Tribune ran a lengthy two-part series of articles on the death penalty, which is highly critical of the way the sentence of death is carried out of the United States. And I believe this is what led directly to Governor Ryan's decision. Imagine what it is like to be an innocent man or woman sitting on death row, perhaps confined to your cell for 23 hours a day, year after year, awaiting execution by the state for a crime you did not commit. Your family and friends will almost certainly believe your assertion of innocence. What does it do to their sense of the legitimacy of government when the government determines to kill their son or daughter who has been wrongfully convicted? I don't think human beings are capable of perfecting the system to the point where innocent men and women will not be executed. I don't find it morally justifiable to support a system where innocent people are executed, especially where alternative punishments are available which protect society. My second moral argument is that we can't keep racial, ethnic, or class bias out of the process of determining who will be selected for death. The state seeks the death penalty in only about 1% of homicides committed. That might be a surprising statistic to you. Only a very few are selected for death. I believe that no country, no matter how free, no matter how democratic, can keep politics and prejudice out of the decision as to who is selected for death. The decision to kill is so often influenced by racial, ethnic, or class bias. It's long been known that if the man is poor and a member of a minority group or a minority ethnic group, he's a better chance of being selected for death than those who are members of the dominant group in society. More recently, it's become apparent that an even more important factor is the race of the victim. If a murder victim is white, male, and so forth, then the murderer is much more likely to be executed. But if the victim was poor, black, or a woman, then the value of the victim was not so great in the eyes of society, and we're far less likely to select the murderer for death. We had a case in Michigan a few years ago where a Chinese man was killed in a bar in Michigan because the guy thought he was Japanese, and those Japanese are building these automobiles that are taking jobs away from Detroiters, and the guy got a year in prison for murder because this Chinese guy wasn't that important in Detroit. Around the world, those from unpopular political, religious, racial, or ethnic groups are much more likely to be selected for death. Geography is also very important. If a crime is committed in one of the 12 states that don't engage in state-sanctioned killing, like Michigan or Iowa, the two states that I've lived in most of my life, you don't have to worry about the death penalty. Both in states that do kill their most notorious criminals, there is great disparity between counties. Some county prosecuting attorneys rarely or never seek the death penalty for practical or moral reasons. But if you're in Texas, and if you have a mind to kill, stay out of Harris County, which is Houston. They are the capital punishment capital of the United States. Not long ago, I saw a report on capital punishment in Harris County, Texas, which said that during the previous year or two, I can't remember exactly the time frame, but during that time frame, there were 30 cases where the prosecutor sought the death penalty. In 15 cases, the defendant was able to hire their own attorney, and none of the 15 got the death penalty. Many of them plea bargained for a fate less than death. The other 15 had court-appointed attorneys, and they all went to trial, and they were all sentenced to death. About 12% of our population is black, and the percentage of who are poor would be pretty similar to that. It's been estimated that 95% of those who have been executed in the past century were poor. At least half of those executed were black. And this is, I think, another interesting statistic, is 90% of people executed for rape were black. To quote Ken Driggs again, "The difference between those who get death sentences and those who get life is mostly found in the quality of the lawyering involved, chance factors of geography and jurisdiction, the race of the victims and the perpetrators, the elections, the composition of the juries, and other factors which have nothing to do with the individual in trial. The choice of who is selected for death is very arbitrary and capricious in the United States of America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. If you have done it unto the least of these, you have done it unto me," as the good book says. My third moral argument is what I'll call redemption and rehabilitation. In the century just past, we saw dramatic examples of the redemptive value of unconditional love based on the teachings of Jesus. Gandhi and Dr. King, probably the two best known examples of this. They have taught us that we must stop the cycle of violence by responding to hatred with love, which brings the possibility of redemption. As King said so often, violence begets violence. Intentional state-sanctioned killing only escalates the climate of violence in our society. We cannot put an end to violence by condoning and practicing violence when there are acceptable alternatives. Martin Buber had a two-hour discussion with Israeli Premier David Ben-Gurion prior to Eichmann's execution. He knew that hanging would not ease anti-Semitism in the world. This is 1962. Whereas showing mercy might have awakened the consciences of at least some anti-Semitic people in the world. I was in attendance in Des Moines in January of 2000 in the great Republican debate when George W. Bush made his famous statement asserting that Christ was his most important political philosopher in his life. Hopefully BYU has added a section on Christ in their history of philosophy course since that time. But anyway, I couldn't help contrasting his statement that night when he said, "Christ has changed my heart," with his actions in approving the execution of Carla Faye Tucker, for whom there was abundant evidence that Christ had changed her heart. My fourth moral argument is that by selecting some of our worst convicts for death, we make healing more difficult. We rightfully have much sympathy for the victim's family and friends. We can certainly understand their feelings when they, in anger, demand the execution of their loved one's killer. I don't know the initial feelings of Bud Welsh, whose daughter was killed in Oklahoma City, or the parents of Matthew Shepard, a gay man who was crucified by two men in Laramie, but in time they came to oppose the death penalty for the killer of their loved one. The parents of Matthew Shepard set a Christ-like example, it seems to me. Their son had been crucified and left to die a slow, excruciating death in a lonely Wyoming countryside in what was obviously a vicious hate crime. But these grieving parents realized that society would be both protected from these vicious hate killers and have greater potential for healing if the murderers were sent to prison for life rather than killed by the state of Wyoming. If they had been sentenced to death, both of them would have had a long line of separate death row appeals, each of which would have been widely publicized. Both of them would have then died in a glorious media martyrdom, martyrs for the cause of hate, inspiring other twisted minds. The media attention to all of these appeals and the two executions would have resurfaced the agony for Matthew Shepard's family and friends, and for the family and friends of the two murderers, who also suffer great loneliness, isolation, and shame because of what their son has done. For the families on both sides of these tragedies, the death penalty makes healing far more difficult. Knowing at the time of the sentencing that these men would never walk the streets again, the Shepherds have been able to get on with their healing process. If they'd been sentenced to death, they would have had to wait 10 or 15 years probably before that sense of justice would have finally been served. We think about the victim's family and friends, but I think we too often think about the perpetrator's family and friends. They did not commit the crime. They feel tremendous shame and rejection by society. The long series of appeals and the day of execution simply renews that pain. Jeff Lundgren, my murderer in Ohio, the RLDS mass murderer, cult murderer, his father, Don, told me that they have had some good support from friends since Jeff's case hit the news, but most of it has come from their non-RLDS friends. Now, they were somewhat alienated from the church as fundamentalists, so that might have been part of the story, but I don't want to let the church off that easily, though. Nearly 2 years after Jeff Lundgren was arrested for his murders, I spent a Saturday afternoon for 4 hours with his parents, Don and Lois. As I was leaving, I was struggling to think of something positive to say. Well, thinking of Dick and Barbara Luff, the second man in this murder who's serving 170 years, I said, and I'm knowing them pretty well by this time, I said, "Well, I suppose the worst is behind you." My thought was that the Luffs now have had nearly 2 years to adjust to the fact that Ron is never going to get out and make whatever adjustments of that they could. Lois Lundgren gave me an odd look and said, "Well, no. I mean, the worst is not behind me. There's still the day of execution. The worst is not behind them as it is for the Luffs, because their son will one day be executed." Jeff Lundgren treated his three sons harshly, probably trying to make men out of them. But his daughter Kristen was his little princess. She was 9 at the time of her father's crimes. She loved her father. The state of Ohio has determined that they will kill him. And what does that do to a 9-year-old girl like Kristen? She's very bright, like her mother, and she may well be in medical school when her father is executed. We hope she's in medical school. She's applying for it now. I suspect she will choose a school that is not in the state of Ohio or in the state of Missouri, where her father's execution is going to be very well publicized. If you watch the movie Dead Man Walking, I think the family of Matthew Ponsell in that movie, it seems to me a pretty good depiction, probably, of a family of a typical death row inmate. Okay, fifth, state-sanctioned killing is dehumanizing to society. It is degrading and dehumanizing to those who must impose the death penalty. for those who impose it, for those who must carry it out, and those who must witness the execution. Again, I think Dead Man Walking was a good depiction of what it is like in these situations. When Harold Hughes became governor of Iowa in 1963, He commuted the death sentences of all death row inmates in Iowa, which I think was about 36 at the time, to a life sentence. There was one federal death row inmate in a Iowa prison at the time, and when his time to be executed came, Governor Hughes contacted President Kennedy, a fellow Democrat, and just begged him to commute the sentence of this federal criminal. Kennedy declined to do so. 25 years later, Governor Hughes was visiting Fort Madison again, and at the prison, and at that time there's only one former death row inmate still at the fort. He asked the former governor why he had spared his life. Hughes said it was simply because of his moral beliefs. Hughes told me, when I had dinner with him one time at Grace, when he spoke there, that most of the death row inmates were eventually released from prison. A few died before they were released. And not one of them had convicted another felony. When the legislature in Iowa was considering the restoration of the death penalty in 1995, former Governor Hughes was horrified and wrote it in the newspaper, "History offers innumerable lessons of how public executions coarsen and brutalize society." I heard that one of those two men that killed Matthew Shepard was a Mormon, but that he was excommunicated, and we also, in effect, had executed. Is that not true? Oh, okay, I've heard that. And we also, more or less, excommunicated Jeff Lundgren, I mean, before this happened, 6 months before he committed the crime. So that makes lets both of us off, I guess. In 1995, the Standing High Council of the RLDS Church adopted a resolution opposing the death penalty. At our Jubilee World Conference held in April of 2000, the conference adopted a resolution against the death penalty by a vote of 2-1, 1,400 and some to 700 and some, just a few votes short of an exact two-thirds majority. Thus, the RLDS Church joined many other religious communities that have opposed the death penalty on moral grounds. I realize that some American churches, like the Southern Baptists, do support the death penalty, and I understand that the larger Latter-day Saint body headquartered out here still favors the death penalty, perhaps taking Section 42 too seriously. Ken Driggs in 1996 reported that only about 10% of LDS members oppose state-sanctioned killing. And the Encyclopedia of Mormonism says that capital punishment is viewed in the doctrines of the church to be an appropriate penalty for murder, and then has some clarifications there thereafter. In 1995, the Standing High Council, the RLDS Church resolution against the death penalty, may have had a role in defeating a Republican attempt to restore the death penalty in Iowa that year. The largest newspaper in the state, the Des Moines Register, credited the religious leadership in Iowa with defeating a bill that was expected to pass because it had been an issue in the governor's race. And the RLDS Church is one of 10 denominations in the Ecumenical Ministry of Iowa, and the Register was crediting the Catholic leadership and the Ecumenical Ministries of Iowa with killing this attempt to restore the death penalty. The EMI does not lobby on a legislative issue unless all 10 member denominations support the position. RLDS stake president Bob Score didn't know where the church stood, because we didn't stand anywhere at that point, nor where he stood on the issue, so he contacted independents. The Standing High Council, as it happened, was already working on the issue at the time and soon adopted a position opposing the death penalty. Score used that position to justify RLDS opposition to reinstatement of the death penalty, and then the EMI supported it, therefore, and was a factor in killing the bill. With RLDS support, they were able to kill the bill. Interestingly enough, one of the state senators who turned against the matter, that is, turned around and against the death penalty, was Senate President Leonard Boswell, an RLDS high priest, former pastor, who's now the only RLDS member of Congress. Boswell had presumed that he would support the death penalty until he was lobbied by the religious leadership, including State President Score. And so his opposition as Senate President and as a moderate Democrat was very crucial in that change. The RLDS action in supporting the abolition of death penalty is consistent with the Church's dedication of our new temple and independence to the pursuit of peace. By refusing to perpetuate the cycle of violence, we help create a more peaceful society. So in closing, I want to quote Sister Helen Prejean, author of Dead Man Walking, which is made into the film I've mentioned. She says, "If someone I love should be killed, I would feel rage, loss, grief, helplessness, perhaps for the rest of my life. It would be arrogant to think I can predict how I would respond to such a disaster. But Jesus Christ, whose life I try to follow, refused to meet hate with hate and violence with violence. I pray for the strength to be like him. I cannot believe in a God who meets out hurt for hurt, pain for pain, torture for torture. Nor do I believe that God invests human representatives with such power to torture and kill. The paths of history are stained with the blood of those who have fallen victim to God's avengers. Kings and popes and military generals and heads of state have killed, claiming God's authority and blessing. I do not believe in such a God." And so, my friends, I say, as Christians and as Latter-day Saints, let us stand with Jesus and Gandhi, Dr. King, the parents of Matthew Shepard, Sister Helen, and many others who, with moral conscience, say we will not perpetuate through our governments the killing of people. Thank you.
Well, I'm not a marathoner like Bill and Mel, but I just returned from running with the Bulls in Pamplona, Spain, so I don't know if that qualifies or not. But it was a good run, I'll tell you that. My role here today is to present a Bart Simpson au contraire perspective, which I will try to do, and please forgive me if I waffle, because I could easily take either side in the argument of capital punishment. I find it a great argument. I just last year taught at Northeastern University in Boston, where 99% of the students and probably the populace are opposed to capital punishment. I teach at Weber State University, where 99% of our students are in favor of capital punishment, and so it makes an interesting schizophrenic experience for me. But I congratulate Bill on making clear to us this morning his personal position on the death penalty and in reviewing some of the issues that are involved with the concept of capital punishment. And I think it's essential that those of us who speak to you make it clear to you what our bias is, what our experience is, what our perspective is. And I hate to detract from Mel's introduction that I'm a good person by going into any detail with that, but perhaps I ought to, just so we have a foundation. I am a criminologist within the discipline of sociology, and I have spent the last 20 years studying executions. My role is that of neutral observer. I interview the men on death row. I spend upwards of, 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 years with them over this period of time, as it takes that long for many of them to get to the point of execution. I spend much of their last 24 hours with them while they're on the death watch, and then I go with them into the execution chamber where they are executed, and then return to my interviews on death row. I have witnessed 6 executions, including the last federal execution of Timothy McVeigh and the firing squad execution of John Albert Taylor, and then that includes all the other lethal injections in the state of Utah. So all those executions since the time of Gary Gilmore. I was not involved with the Gary Gilmore execution, although Gary's ashes rest on my desk at Weber State. I was interviewing Vern D'Amico, his uncle, one evening, and I asked Vern, did you actually scatter Gary's ashes over, I believe it was Springville Canyon? He said, I did. He said, all but a handful. He said, you want them? He said, they're buried underneath the rose bush out back. And he went out back and proceeded to dig them up. So I have written 3 books on the process, including the book called The Unforgiven, Utah's Executed Men, which are the stories of all of the men executed in the state of Utah. Signature Books and I had a little battle. They wanted to call it Sons of Perdition. I thought that might be a doctrinal problem. I wanted to call it 47 Men and One Horse. They thought that was not appropriate, and so we compromised on The Unforgiven, and we could still have a doctrinal discussion on that. My latest book is based on questions people ask about executions. Allen and Bacon is publishing that. It'll be out in January. Again, we battled over the title. They said, what question are you most frequently asked? And I said, the one I would like to use for a title. They said, what is that? And I said, it is. Why don't they just shoot the bastards? Well, they sent that out for review, and the professors who would adopt the book were not too excited about that. And so we have settled on Inside the Death Chamber. The only book I really entitled the way I wanted was entitled Dance Hall Ladies, which is my study of all of the women who have been executed in the 20th century in the United States. The problem is everybody thinks that's a book on prostitution. So either way, I'm not going to get through that. But it has been an interesting journey for me, because I think to study capital punishment, to have an opinion on capital punishment, to look at capital punishment, you need to know what's going on. You need to know what happens. And while everybody can't do that, then I see that as my role as sharing that. Now, I have learned that it's a lonely job trying to remain neutral on a topic that's as emotional as the death penalty. What I have found is you have 2 enemies instead of 1. If I would take one side or the other, at least I'd have a little support. At this point, I have none. And so I come here well aware that I expect 5-minute head start. I'll sneak out the back door and keep running. But I believe, in terms of stating my position on capital punishment, that a society has a right to impose whatever punishment it feels appropriate, whatever sanctions it wishes to use. But I do not trust our justice system because of its capriciousness to do so fairly. So I consider that a middle-of-the-road position, but maybe that's a non-position, and we can certainly go from there. With specific regard to Bill's paper, he's been involved with some pretty heavy cases, and he has undergone a conversion process since his pro-capital punishment high school days, and has now become a convert to the anti-capital punishment position for 35 years, I have to admit, without trying to offend anyone, that I'm somewhat cautious about conversion experiences. Seldom do they result in middle-of-the-road positions, but rather cause one to go from one extreme to the other. And so I assume that Bill has done a nice flip-flop. But that is it, be that as it may, Bill has made two arguments, I think. One, Christians should oppose capital punishment on both secular and religious grounds. And two, that as a faith community becomes successful, as the world defines it, building impressive churches and universities, attaining material prosperity for its members, and achieving stardom for some of its members, which may be a sour grapes argument, but we could look at that, it becomes easy to live in a relatively low state of tension with the surrounding culture, including favoring the death penalty. I would like to just briefly address each of those and then I guess give you the opportunity to attack either one of us or both of us. On the first one about Christians opposing the death penalty on secular and religious grounds, I find that we use rather loosely such words as humane and inhumane, moral, immoral, and make statements such as Christ would do this or Christ would do that, and to do so, I believe, assumes a knowledge or judgment that we're not entitled to make. I not only do not claim to know what Christ would or would not do, nor do I claim to know in any detail what his plan is or how he plans to carry it out. My knowledge of right and wrong is so limited that I can't even decide if killing is right or wrong, and maybe some of you have that knowledge that I don't have. Should Nephi have killed Laban? Was that right or wrong? And in either case, speak to the death penalty. And should there have been no capital punishment at the time of Christ's execution? And if not, would there have been an atonement or not? Regarding Bill's second argument, that institutions, including churches, sacrifice their integrity in exchange for social and political acceptability, I think that's what he said or meant, especially regards the position of capital punishment, I would take issue. Specifically, the Mormon Church, and I insist on using the word Mormon Church. I could stutter around with Jesus Christ of all this and LDS and all that. I am a Mormon. I've been stoned as a Mormon. I've been picked on as a Mormon. I will die a Mormon. I mean, Mormon means a lot to me, and so I'm going to stay there. So if that's offensive to you, I'm sorry. But with regard to the Mormon Church, then, it seems not to have fluctuated in its pro-capital punishment skew. If anything, it's gone the opposite direction of what Bill implies. The church has not joined the ranks of the liberal society in an anti-death penalty stance, but rather has reiterated its position of following the law of the land. And I think Bill implied that the church presently does have a pro-capital punishment stance. It does not. The stance is that in England we do not favor capital punishment because it is not the law of the land. And in Utah we do because it is the law of the land. In those states where it isn't, we don't because it is not the law of the land. So to me, the official position of the church, and it became obvious at the time of the execution of Gary Arthur Bishop. I spent a lot of time with him. You'll recall he was executed for sexually molesting and killing five young boys here in state, returned Mormon missionary, all of those things. Was concerned prior to his execution as to which method of death he should select. Should he die by firing squad and have his blood spilled? Should he do it by lethal injection? It was his choice. He wanted to make the right choice. He wrote to the first presidency of the church. Received a response back, said it didn't matter how he died. If he was going to die, he could die any way he wanted. So blood atonement is pretty well, I think, taken care of in that regard. Now, whether the church has moved, whether it was an official position, I guess we could argue that forever. But the official position, as I understand it, and as I received it from the church as I wrote the book, has to do with the fact that it is the law of the land that is followed, and there is not a doctrinal position on capital punishment, as I understand it. Finally, as Professor Russell's admonition, the one he concluded with, and let me quote his, and then I would like to amend that to mine, and then we can argue about it. Let us, as Christians and as Latter-day Saints, stand with Jesus, Gandhi, Dr. King, and the parents of Matthew Shepard, and stop the cycle of violence which we perpetuate. When we, through our government, kill people, I would rewrite that in my own words. Let us, as Christians, stand with Christ and use our agency, minds, and personal inspiration to take a personal stand on capital punishment and other social issues without the interference or mandate of a mortal organization imposing an institutional mandate on our conscience. I think it is a decision, a personal decision. It's not one that is unarguable. If my position on capital punishment is pro-capital punishment, it is an emotional stance. There is no support either way. There is no scientific evidence either way. It is not a scientific argument. It is a moral argument and continues to be a moral argument. And who can define your morality? Who can define my morality? Who can even define the moral argument? I would note that my experience also does not bear out Professor Russell's concern that capital punishment degrades and dehumanizes those who impose the sentence of death, those who carry it out, and those who must witness it. On the contrary, those I have observed who participate in the execution process do so with great compassion and concern for the process, the public, the victims, and the person being executed. Many of them suffer a great psychological problem as a result of it. Many wardens have quit their jobs. Many have had heart attacks. It is a burden. It is a difficult thing on them, but they do it with compassion and with concern. They are not there out of compulsion or vindictiveness, but rather as officials of the state. And so I would suggest to us that it is not an issue we can argue about. It is not an issue that anyone else can present to us or give to us. It is one that we come to through thought and discussion. And again, we can find statistics on both sides. We can find arguments on both sides. But for me, it becomes a personal issue. Thank you.
Let's see, if this mic, comes off, maybe we could pass it back and forth easier. I guess I'll just make a quick comment. I didn't mean to suggest that the church, LDS Church, shifted on this issue for... I didn't mean to say the church shifted on this issue because of desire for social acceptability. I'm just saying that in general, churches, as they become more acculturated and accommodated to the society around them, they will tend to have less conflict with society. And in this particular case, since society is very much in favor of the death penalty, it's convenient for Christians of all types to be influenced by society and support the death penalty for secular reasons rather than Christian reasons. And I guess I'd also say I wasn't converted to I want to debate the idea that I did it for emotional reasons. I mean, I think it was an intellectual journey. I mean, that series of articles in the Detroit Free Press, you know, was simply intellectually looking at the facts of the case and coming to great doubts about Willie Calloway's guilt and, you know, the economic argument and so forth. It's a combination of practical and, but I wouldn't in any way equate it to, you know, a religious conversion where all of a sudden I'm this true believer and have my position simply because of my emotional views. So, comment if you want, and then we'll have questions before.
Well, I would argue any position on capital punishment is an emotional issue. There is no intellectual issue. You can't scientifically or objectively take either position or support either position. And so, while I respect that, I just don't think that you can come to it as a result of that.
Yes, front row here.
I have a question, and then my question is going to be based on an assumption that I'm not sure of. I'm making the assumption that the church here in Utah, the vast majority of members, would be polling for a capital punishment, that they're majority, and that the church in Independence, in a polling, I would make the assumption that would be against. So my question is a sociological question: what would go into these two faith communities in terms of the difference in concerning this issue?
Well, I don't know. I think at the World Conference when we adopted the resolution by a 2-1 margin, I was kind of overwhelmed. I was just hoping it would pass by 50.1%. But I think it is a much different history between the two churches in the last century plus. And the RLDS Church certainly in the last generation has moved toward mainstream Protestantism, where there is strong opposition to the death penalty. And so then also 1/4 of our active members left over the ordination of women, which meant the most fundamental church members had left. I think that made passing it much easier. Plus, a lot of those votes for the resolution were from outside the United States. It's hard to say how the RLDS people, the delegates within the United States, would have voted. So it's hard hard to know, but I'd say we're more 50-50 probably within the United States, but I guess in Utah it's probably more the other way.
Well, I guess there are several issues related to this. One, you could talk about Utah and the church, but you could also talk about the Western United States. And the Western United States, obviously, is very pro-capital punishment in general. So just as a part of that general culture. The other part is a historical thing. If you were to ask most Mormons why they believe in capital punishment, they would say because they believe the murderer must have his blood shed and pay for his crime, which is not their doctrine, but traditionally they believe it's their doctrine. And so based on that, that's a large part of it as well. The other part is, I think capital punishment is one of those cultural traits within the United States, traditionally pro-capital punishment. Part of my reason for going to Spain was not to run with the bulls, it was to study the role of bullfighting, and the bullfighter as executioner, the bull as victim, and even more general, the continuation of the support of bullfighting as a cultural part of the Spanish culture. And I think the death penalty is a part of our culture, of the United States culture, and will continue to be so. So in spite of logic, in spite of all these other kinds of things, we continue to hold on to that cultural tradition, and I think it continues to be a cultural tradition, not only in the Mormon Church, but in the West in general.
Would you say that a Midwest versus West perspective?
You know, I don't know anything about the Midwest. My philosophy is that anything east of Wyoming is weird. And so I'm not able to be very objective about that.
Well, the states that are opposed to that do not practice death penalty tend to be in the north central states. That's probably the largest geographical area. I'm going to try to get these questions on the mic. Better for the tape.
I'd just like to address the question of the death penalty perpetuating violence. About a year or so ago in the news, there was an article about in California, some prison guards were sponsoring gladiator fights among prisoners. For those who have paid attention to what goes on in a lot of these prisons, couldn't an argument be made that there's far more violence in a lifetime in prison than there would be in a quick and relatively painless death?
Yeah. So the perpetrator who stays in prison for life then will commit violence, and if we killed him, he wouldn't be.
And have violence against him.
Yeah. Yeah. Possibly. A lot of states, the death row, you're on a 23-1 basis. I don't know whether you know the numbers on that, but in some states, you're like in Ohio, you're in prison in your cell 23 hours a day and only out 1 hour a day, so you're not able to commit much violence. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that or not. But.
I just state that is changing. You know, you really can't find death row in most of our prisons anymore. It's referred to as death status, and they're mixed with maximum security inmates. They're even now starting to find them jobs within the prisons, and in essence saying, you know, we're going to be around a long time, let's do some things. There was one suggestion at the Utah State Prison, which never came to pass, thank heaven, but it was, let's take these new kids coming into the prison, put them with the death row inmates, house them with them, so that they can sort of learn what the prison is all about. That's a little scary to me. But the idea is sort of mainstreaming, or to some extent mainstreaming, some of these death row inmates. And death rows seem to be sort of disappearing in many prisons, and they're talking about death status rather than death rows.
Yeah, I know Missouri is that way. Nadine, I'll come to you next.
I have several comments. The first, I wanted to point out that I think that the cost argument is an intellectual argument. You can debate that if you want, but I don't think that's an emotional argument. Secondly, I went to a program at the Utah Mid-Year State Bar Convention where they discussed the death penalty and lethal injection, and it was pointed out that it's probably a very painful way to die, and the person who's being executed is immobilized so that they can't react, so that the people who are witnessing the execution don't see that the person is in a great deal of pain, but they are. Another concern I have about the death penalty is that I think it has a very uneven application, so that people in one state might be executed for something that they would not be executed in another state, or even county to county. I think you touched on that, Bill. And I've wondered if we're going to have a death penalty, which I generally would prefer to do away with it, but if we're going to have a death penalty, if there could be some kind of national standard review so that the application of the death penalty is more even-handed. And then finally, 9/11 gave me pause about my opposition to the death penalty, and I remember in the days after 9/11 hearing somebody, I think he was from George Washington University, who had studied terrorists and found that they continued to support and urge terrorism from their jail cells. There was no conversion over, their being in jail did not rehabilitate them in any way, and their continued living encouraged other terrorists. Now, I realize they would be martyrs if they were executed too, but then once they're gone, they can't continue to encourage perpetration of terrorism. And I wondered if either of you'd like to comment about any of those things.
Kate, you want to comment? Or?
Well, you're right about lethal injection. I think it's probably the most immoral way, if you're going to talk about morality, to take a life. The word on death row is you are awake, you are aware, you know what's going on. And so there's sort of a backlash among some of the inmates in terms of that kind of concept. Firing squad, to me, is the most humane, the quickest, and it ties in with the justice system. Why take if you're going to have capital punishment, take it out of the justice system and put it in the medical world where you have gurneys and IVs? I mean, it's nothing like another operation or a surgical procedure. I'm still thinking on your comment about the cost as being an intellectual argument. I'm not sure I accept that. We can't agree on cost in the first place. We can't get a good figure on cost. And number two, are you suggesting to me that opposition to death penalty is based on cost, that it's an economic argument, and that life is based on what it costs us to do this? I have some difficulty with that, and you know, it should not just be an economic argument, it seems to me. And I've forgotten everything else. My mind doesn't hold two thoughts at once.
Yeah, but I would add to Nadine, I would think that the deterrence argument is also an intellectual argument. And so at least my practical arguments were intellectual arguments. The moral arguments would be more emotional arguments.
Kay, I think you said that you believe that any society has the right to consequence crime as they see fit.
You can do the Nazi thing with me?
No, I'm doing the cutting off the hand for theft thing. Do you believe that's acceptable for any society to choose that?
Society has chosen.
I know.
It is a law, and they do it.
I know.
Well, as I hear the argument here, it seems to me that we're seeing the government taking a position, that is the society through its government taking a position, and we argue the morality or immorality of that. If we apply it to the larger activities of society, like war, isn't it just as immoral to deal with, we make war a moral issue rather than an immoral issue, it seems to me. Could you respond to that?
Well, I see it as a different issue, even though, you know, I'm obviously a person who, as opposed to the death penalty on moral grounds, would have higher standards of ethics that would have to be answered before they would engage in war, whereas possibly people who are pro-death penalty would engage in war more easily. But, you know, questions of state and the security of the state and so forth are involved, whereas in the case of somebody who's committed a murder, the question simply is, how do we protect society from this danger to society and still do it in the best way possible for society?
Well, as I suggest, I have a hard time with moral and immoral, and I don't worry about that. I think government makes laws, government has a right to make laws, and they have a right to enforce those laws, and that is a totally separate thing from moral and immoral. You put morality in a religious issue. And the problem I have is when you start jumping over, so that when churches start taking positions on issues. For example, prostitution, I think, is a great issue that we get in a lot of trouble with. Is prostitution moral or immoral? Well, most people believe it's immoral. But when you come down to public policy, the best thing that we could do from an intellectual point of view would be to decriminalize prostitution, keep it in certain areas, control it, license it, examine the ladies so that they have medical clearance. So from a practical intellectual point of view, public policy should go one way, but those of us who think it's immoral go the other direction, and how you start imposing that, and when you start jumping back and forth over that line, we have some real problems with public policy and the imposition of what's moral and immoral, I think. And war is one of those, I think.
But I disagree with what you're saying about morality being separate. Our criminal law is based very much on our moral views, almost all of our, I shouldn't say almost all, but many of our criminal sanctions are directed at things that the society considers immoral, like murder.
Whose moral views?
Well, yeah, well, it's a moral view of a crime is something a majority of the legislature and the governor, you know, hold as a crime. I think we are, our time is up. Let's have the final word.
I just have a question for Dr. Gillespie. I'm an academician at Northern Arizona University and a criminologist myself. And I respect the role of an academician, and you're trying to be neutral, but I'm going to give you this question. In Arizona, we may, as a referendum state, vote on, as the people, to sanction the death penalty or not. If that came to a vote to you, then you would... Would you abstain from voting?
That's not a nice question at all. I come from a long history of people who have committed those executions. My great-grandfather committed one of the first firing squads in the state. His execution was 8 days after the crime, and so I think I owe it to my family to probably vote neutral.
Well, thanks very much for coming. Is there anybody who just really had to have a laugh? I didn't get further back in the room, but if not, let's go ahead and quit then. Thanks very much for coming, and thanks, Kate.